This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Great Lakes Echo commentator Gary Wilson takes a look ahead at the 2016 presidential election and what it could mean for Great Lakes policy. But first, something unusual recently happened in Michigan, an earthquake. It was the second strongest ever recorded in the state, but it did not cause any serious damage or injuries. We're going to discuss earthquakes in Michigan and the Great Lakes region with David Barnes. He's a professor of geosciences at Western Michigan University. David Barnes, thank you for being with us.
You're very welcome.
Let's kind of go to the basics here. Maybe some people learned this in science class a long time ago, but I bet many people of my age and older who don't have a profession like yours, or we study this all the time, have forgotten. What causes an earthquake?
Well, earthquakes are studied by seismologists, and I'm not one of those, but as a geologist, this is pretty basic stuff. Earthquakes are caused by the breakage of rocks and the transmission of energy waves, a variety of different kinds of energy waves, from the point where the rocks broke to where they are perceived, those energy waves are perceived at the surface. And the reason this event was rather unusual is that most of the tremors that we feel in Michigan end up being energy waves, the result of energy waves, which have propagated or traveled great distances, fairly substantial distances, from more common locations for the generation of earthquakes, the New Madrid Fault Zone or area in southern Illinois and Missouri and Kentucky is a very noteworthy area of generation of earthquakes. So, but this one actually was generated, was the result of a breakage of rocks quite deep in the Earth's interior, right here in Michigan, of course, right near Galesburg.
How rare is it for Michigan to have earthquake activity either right underneath our state or from a surrounding state?
Well, first and foremost, the seismic activity, earthquake activity, the perceived earth motions that we perceive as observers or result in minor damage occur as a result of breakage of rocks here, uncommonly, but more commonly from more distant events. And the U.S. Geological Survey, which has the responsibility of evaluating resources and hazards and whatnot, has designated Michigan and the surrounding areas one of the lowest areas of likelihood of seismic activity and seismic damages. So very unusual would certainly be the answer that this doesn't happen very much here, and that's well documented.
A lot of people got a good chuckle on social media after the earthquake. Someone took a picture of lawn chairs, which I think were plastic, and one of them was tipped over, and it said, "The Michigan earthquake, we will rebuild." That's pretty funny. I think we can also breathe a sigh of relief that nothing serious happened. And is it unlikely that even if we do have an earthquake in Michigan, is it unlikely that we would get any sort of serious damage, the likes of which we've seen across the world and in some cities in the United States which have had earthquakes?
Absolutely. It is not expected that we would have sizable earthquakes. A real quick analogy is if you grab a stick, sizable stick, and bend it. The breakage of that stick is going to be a function of how much force you can put on the stick. The bigger the stick, the more force is necessary, the more energy that's going to be released by that breakage. We just don't have forces expressed by this very low likelihood of seismic activity in Michigan. We just don't have those geological forces that would normally break rocks. Again, it's quite unusual to have such an event, even a fairly low energy one here in Michigan. But it is the scale of the geological forces, the actual energy that's present, for example, in California or more recently here, this tragic earthquake in Nepal. There are geological forces that are capable of generating very, very high energy earthquake events. And we just know that those forces don't exist here through various measurements and whatnot. So the likelihood of significant earthquakes, damaging earthquakes, is very low just because of the geological setting that we live in. And that's probably a good thing in the sense of potential damages.
The earthquake which happened near Galesburg has been said to be the second strongest earthquake ever recorded in Michigan. The strongest occurred back in the 40s, about 35 miles away from Galesburg in Coldwater. Is there anything to read into that, or is it likely just coincidence that these two earthquakes happened within a relatively small area of each other?
Well, the two things you need for an earthquake are the breakage of rocks and forces sufficient to break them. We know that there are many, many faults in Michigan. By that, I mean geological faults, areas where previously rocks have broken and moved relative one to another. Most of that action happened hundreds of millions of years ago when this was a rather more active geological setting, when the Appalachian Mountains were being built. Those forces no longer exist in this area. The configuration of plates and other things that people may know something about is simply different than when those faults were formed. However, those are zones of weaknesses, places where the rocks are more susceptible to breakage because they have been previously broken. So the proximity of modern seismic events is really related to the location of these pre-existing faults or zones of weakness. So it's not surprising to see reoccurrence in similar locations, but faults themselves are sort of planar features that extend fair distances. And we believe that most of the faults, the old ancient faults around here that are potentially susceptible to motion, are oriented kind of northwest and southeast. So it's not surprising that you'd see faults close to one another, and having them line up would make a little more sense. But closely spaced faults might also exist in the subsurface.
Almost as soon as the earthquake hit, there were some questions raised about whether or not human activities, particularly fracking, hydraulic fracturing, could lead to an earthquake in Michigan. The Kalamazoo Gazette looked into this. They talked to you, and you were quoted as saying, "I'm as certain as a scientist can be that there is no connection." Why are you that certain?
Well, first of all, people are constantly asking me about things, and I always tell them about error bars. That is, that we know things to the point of what we expect to be most likely, but there's always some uncertainty, and I think most of the people in the public just aren't willing to accept that there can be uncertainty about things. Well, that's nonsense.
Especially in science.
In sciences. And, you know, we are being irresponsible if we suggest that things are unquestionably true. Francis Bacon said, "I'm aware of relationships, but I'm very patient about determining the actual relationships of things." So the idea here is that we can make predictions about the likelihood of things occurring to more or less reasonable certainty. And the idea of relationship to hydraulic fracturing in this case is comforting in the sense that it's about as sure as you can be for several reasons that there are no human activities, specifically induced seismicity, specifically hydraulic fracturing related to this seismic event. And those things include, first, that there hasn't been any hydraulic fracturing activity anywhere near this area. There's been some hydraulic fracturing in Michigan, but certainly not close enough to have any influence on this particular fault.
Mostly north of there.
North of here, yeah. And secondly, we are very confident that injection of fluids into the subsurface have initiated or induced seismic activity in some cases. The trouble is that there was no injection of fluids for any reason in this location, anywhere near this location, other than an injection well at Pfizer factory, which has been ongoing for decades, and I'm not even sure they're still injecting fluids in that well about 3 or 4 miles away. So no fracking's been done. There's been no injection of fluid for any other purposes. And probably the most clear and cutting evidence to indicate there's no relationship is that there actually are some wells that are fairly recently drilled to about 4,000 feet in the subsurface, which sounds like a lot. But this earthquake, our best guess, the seismic evidence, U.S. Geological Survey suggests the actual rupture of rocks occurred at about 20 or so thousand feet. So we're talking 15,000 feet away from even the deepest portion of a borehole that's several miles away. So those relationships are about as strong evidence to suggest that there is no relationship between human activities, induced seismicity, in the seismic event.
Well, let me just ask this question, though. I think you touched on it, but let's talk a little more about what are the situations where human activity could lead to some sort of seismic reaction.
There's no question. It's been almost, again, to reasonable scientific certainty, there's almost no question that the injection of fluids under high pressure, in this case, mostly waste disposal, and that's quite a common activity throughout the U.S. and especially in Michigan. There's been quite a large volume of liquid wastes injected into the subsurface for disposal, and certainly an event in near Youngstown in Ohio, where waste disposal resulted in the slippage of a pre-existing fault, was pretty well documented. Basically, you inject fluids and you make the fault slippery and induce them to move if they're existing forces. They just need a little push, if you will, to actually cause seismicity. So no question that there is induced seismicity. A lot of research has been done in Oklahoma, where, again, deep waste disposal has been undertaken at comparable depths, actually, quite deep in the subsurface, comparable to the depths of the origin of the seismic event here in Michigan. But there is no borehole anywhere near this seismic event, the breakage of rocks in Michigan, that came anywhere near that depth, about 5 or 6,000 feet is certainly the deepest borehole anywhere in southern Michigan.
The Christian Science Monitor actually covered this earthquake when it happened in Michigan and said that scientists have long known that faults lie under the state, being Michigan. They said that the lack of seismic activity combined with the fact that the faults lie so deep beneath the surface has meant that such faults have been difficult to find or study. Purely as a scientist, is the fact that we had an earthquake an opportunity for you and perhaps for other people who are interested in research to learn a little bit more about what is going on underneath the state?
Absolutely. It's an interesting contrast. A scientist might describe an earthquake as a natural phenomenon, while the public might refer to it as a natural disaster. And that the idea of a disaster versus a phenomenon is really a human judgment or a personal judgment. And certainly the damages that might result from a large destructive earthquake could, without question, be called a natural disaster. But an earthquake event, in this case, again, quite confidently, this was a non-human influenced activity that generates information. The different waves that are generated by rock breakages travel at different speeds, and the arrival times at a distant point from the origin can give us an indication of the position. Kind of like watching a lightning storm. You see the lightning and then you hear the boom some seconds later, and you can determine the distance of the lightning from you based on the difference in travel time between light and sound waves. Similarly, with earthquake waves, information can help us determine the specific location and other important information, the movement directions and et cetera, about an earthquake event. This is what seismologists do. I'm not one of those, so I don't know a lot about this sort of detailed analysis. But interestingly enough, we've actually had a couple of students who've been working on the geological response, the effects of fluids, which were actually traveled through these faults hundreds of millions of years ago when they were very active, and the resulting geological changes, the changes in the rock materials associated with those faults. And in fact, we know that some of those changes have actually resulted in the migration and accumulation of oil and gas in the subsurface in direct spatial association with these faults. And the largest oil field in Michigan, called the Albion-Scipio oil field in Calhoun and Hillsdale County, is an oil accumulation which is directly related to one of these ancient faults. All of this activity happened millions of years ago, but we are exploiting these resources based on our knowledge of the position of this old fault. It ends up being quite parallel to the one here in Galesburg. And in fact, there are boreholes that have been drilled and oil is being produced currently from oil wells that were located because of the knowledge of where this old fault was. And lo and behold, nature gives us evidence of it being there by having an earthquake. So it's really quite an interesting story. In other words, the location of these oil wells was based on some high-resolution imaging of the subsurface that identified the presence of a zone of weakness or an old fault. And that we know that oil and gas accumulations, in many cases, in certain formations, can be related to these faults. So the boreholes were located on the basis of that information. And again, the activity on that fault was really quite a surprise, but not really.
Does that mean also then seismic activity can change the composition of what's below the surface and may lead to a situation, and probably not immediately, but down the road, where oil and gas may be available in a place where previously we didn't think we could find it?
That's a long story. I'm not sure you want to hear the whole details, but the long and short of it is that in the state of Michigan, there is an occurrence of oil and gas that we know to be the result of geological processes associated with faults. Now, most of this took place, the most noteworthy ones, again, this big field in Calhoun and Hillsdale County. Most of this activity, this geological processes that's more complicated than you really want to hear about, occurred hundreds of millions of years ago. So we can locate oil accumulations, potentially anyway, on the basis of the identification of faults, because in many cases those faults are associated with oil accumulations. The fact that they would continue to generate oil is not quite right. So,
David Barnes, thank you for your time.
You're very welcome.
David Barnes is a professor of geosciences at Western Michigan University. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. It will be at least 8 months before any vote is actually cast that will help determine which candidates will represent the two major parties in next year's race for the White House. But commentator Gary Wilson says whatever happens between now and then is likely to set a different course for the politics of the Great Lakes. Wilson wrote about this in his recent commentary titled, "Will Shifting Political Winds Impair Great Lakes Recovery?" It appeared on the Great Lakes Echo website. Gary Wilson, thank you for being with us.
Hey, Gordon. Good to be with you. It's been a while.
So in your piece, you write that the political tailwind that the Great Lakes have had since 2008 will likely shift no matter who wins the presidency in 2016. Explain why you think that shift is likely.
Sure, Gordon. What happened beginning a few years before 2008, when Barack Obama was elected president, there was a groundswell of activity in the Great Lakes region pushing for two major issues. One was the passage of the Great Lakes Compact, which was designed to keep Great Lakes water in the Great Lakes basin where it belongs and keep it being sent to arid areas like California and Arizona. The other was the move to really make a full court press for Great Lakes restoration, the multi-billion dollar program that would require federal money to do things like to clean up old toxic hotspots, restore wetlands, and a whole host of other issues that have been lingering for decades. Everything lined up politically in 2008. There had been a lot of movement behind the scenes, and Cameron Davis, who I referenced in the article, when he was working for one of the environmental groups, he got to know then State Senator Barack Obama a little bit. And he started planting, you know, the seeds with the then State Senator about the importance of Great Lakes issues. Now, as a state senator, I can tell you that the Great Lakes weren't Barack Obama's number one priority. But, you know, you start way in advance with politicians and you kind of keep at them. So there was a lot of momentum that built. And then when Barack Obama became President Obama, he had made a campaign pledge prior to the election that he would invest billions of dollars in the Great Lakes. And he, for the most part, has kept that pledge. Now, those are unusual circumstances. I don't know that it's ever going to line up like that again. And 2016, his election is not all that far away. So people in the region are starting to think about it.
Of course, you know, one of the factors that plays into that scenario that you point out there is that President Obama spent many years in Chicago before he became a United States senator and then president of the United States. When I was in high school many moons ago, I remember a civics teacher talking about how there were certain issues which are ideological and then certain issues which are regional. And I'm wondering how much the Great Lakes is still a regional issue where politicians of both parties may work on some things together and how much it maybe has become an ideological issue even for candidates who are from the Great Lakes.
I think that it's mostly a regional issue, Gordon. Within the region, you would hear environmental groups and others, some elected officials talking about the importance of the Great Lakes nationally. They're referred to as a national treasure, you know, as is the Everglades, as is the Chesapeake, as the Chesapeake Bay, as is Puget Sound. But I still think that it's mostly a regional issue. The challenge for everybody is how do you make a connection, say, with Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush, who are, you know, Rand Paul. None of those are from the Great Lakes region or even close to it, and they have no geographical connection. They have no affinity toward the Great Lakes. What is your selling point with them? Because you have to know that, you know, everybody has got a wish list for new presidential hopefuls. And if I'm, say, Jeb Bush from Florida with Texas roots, why would I take a special interest in the Great Lakes other than to say they're very important and I will certainly pay attention to them? That's the challenge.
Let's step back for just a moment before we start looking ahead more to 2016. How would you grade President Obama's record on Great Lakes issues?
I've said many times, Gordon, that President Obama has been the best friend that the Great Lakes have ever had. They had languished for decades in terms of federal support for a lot of these problems. And to his credit, He made a pledge to invest billions of dollars in the Great Lakes to restore them. And for the most part, he has kept that pledge. I think the number in the past 4 years, or 6 years, I'm sorry, is approaching $2 billion. The money is only part of the issue. He has really turned, I don't want to say a deaf ear to the issue of Asian carp, but many in the Great Lakes region, people, the environmentalists for sure, in Michigan, Senator Debbie Stabenow has been right on the point of the Asian carp issue, you know, pleading for the federal government to do something, specifically the Army Corps of Engineers. The Obama administration has not been on board with what Senator Stabenow and others want, and that's physical separation of the Great Lakes from the Mississippi. The state of Michigan has been to court a number of times, including the Supreme Court, wanting action from the federal government. And the Solicitor General has, part of the executive branch, has argued against Michigan and other states, you know, repeatedly, and they've always prevailed. So if people are looking for something to criticize President Obama about, it's his stance on Asian carp. He's also, in his budget proposals, has cut some money for clean drinking water funds. I think that's more of a peripheral issue, and it reflects the politics of the necessity to negotiate with Republican budget appropriators to show some cuts. Not a good thing, but I don't think it's a big deal. You know, if I had to tag a President Obama with a grade, I'd give him a solid B.
So earlier you mentioned the idea of trying to get the attention or the interest of candidates who are not from the Great Lakes region but are still running for president. What is the case that issues which take place within the Great Lakes have impact beyond these states throughout the nation?
I think a big issue that everybody can kind of get their arms around, because it is national, and it's drinking water quality. We saw what happened in Toledo last year when the Toledo residents, 500,000, 400,000 in greater Toledo, and some tens of thousands in Michigan near Lake Erie, were without drinking water for 3 days. I think we've seen what's happened in Flint, where they've got a different problem from Toledo's, but Flint has been struggling to provide safe drinking water to its residents for months now. And I think it's to the point where Flint residents have lost confidence in the city's ability to deliver clean drinking water. Those issues, while not good for Michigan and the region, are broader than the region. And everybody has drinking water problems at some point in their state and in their municipalities. I think that's an angle where people could talk to these candidates from outside the region about the importance of drinking water quality. It impacts them in their states. Certainly, it's an issue in Florida. I'm not sure so much about Rand Paul in Kentucky, but I think that's a way to approach these candidates. It's something that they have in common in their state with the Great Lakes region.
Well, of course, there are other parts of the country where they're saying we don't have water because we've had a drought or something along those lines. And they kind of look at the Great Lakes and wonder if they could somehow get some of that water. Is that where, again, the regional politics become a little stronger, where there's unity for the most part in the Great Lakes region that we don't want our water siphoned off for some other area of the country where they don't have as much drinking water as they want at the moment?
You're exactly right, Gordon. That is one area where there is strong regional leadership. The Great Lakes Compact is pretty strong medicine to keep arid regions from being able to tap into the Great Lakes. If you remember, going back to the early part of the 2008 presidential campaign, when Bill Richardson from New Mexico, he was a candidate, and he made a rather careless statement regarding water. He said that we ought to look to Wisconsin. Wisconsin is awash in water. And that set off all kinds of alarms and red flags. And, you know, people contacted him and his staff rather quickly and say, I don't know how you can come to the Great Lakes region, be it Michigan, Wisconsin, Illinois, any state in the Great Lakes region, and have credibility when you're talking about trying to siphon water off to send it to New Mexico. So you're right. There is strong regional leadership about keeping Great Lakes water in the Great Lakes Basin.
In any presidential election, which of course, the big issues are usually the economy, perhaps national security is in there. So regardless of who the candidates are, how much attention can you expect Great Lakes issues to get before sometime in November of 2016?
Not a lot. That's the honest answer. You talk about Great Lakes issues, you know, what drives the campaigns, jobs, what drives the campaigns, depending on your perspective, spending, what drives the campaign, you know, social issues. I don't want to say the environment is not important. Obviously, it is. And I think any candidate would say that the environment is important. But, you know, we have to be realistic. The jobs, the economy, those types of things are, you know, the bread and butter issues, especially in, you know, states like Michigan, which have been down but are coming back and want to, you know, maintain that momentum. Ohio, you know, in a similar situation. Any candidate going into those states is going to, you know, talk about jobs, the economy, other things. And, oh, by the way, yes, you guys have a lot of water here, and, you know, we certainly are interested in taking care of it. Thank you.
Let me wander off here and admit that this question is going to include some pretty hypothetical scenarios. But we do have some candidates who have expressed interest who are from Great Lakes states, including Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, governor of Ohio, John Kasich, has expressed some interest. As we speak right now, we don't know yet how serious Rick Snyder, the governor of Michigan's interest is in getting into the presidential race. And of course, Hillary Clinton was a senator from New York, all in the Great Lakes region. If we reach a point where we've started to narrow the field down and those candidates are still in it in some way as we're getting late into the primary process at least, does that tilt this at all, in your opinion, again, very hypothetical, and get a little more attention for Great Lakes issues than we have if all of the candidates come from states that don't border the Great Lakes?
It does, and I can take you back to 2004, Gordon. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative was just starting to gain momentum, and there had been a bill introduced in the Senate targeting $20 billion over some number of years for the Great Lakes. Somebody, I forget which senator from the region, introduced the legislation, and John Kerry, who was a candidate and the senator from Massachusetts at that point, signed on to the bill as a co-sponsor. Prior to that, the Great Lakes region had been pretty much stonewalled by President Bush at the time, President George W. Bush, the son, on Great Lakes issues. You know, President Bush would say all the right things, but he did essentially nothing. All of a sudden, President Bush started paying attention a little bit more to the Great Lakes. You know, as we talked a minute ago, I don't think it's the Great Lakes and the environment are going to be an issue that's going to decide the election, but I'm not sure about Governor Walker. He's from Wisconsin. He's a wild card. But I think Governor Kasich from Ohio and I think Hillary Clinton from New York, I think that there's a chance that we can get a little bit more attention from them related to the Great Lakes.
Gary Wilson, as always, thank you for your time.
Always good to be with you, Gordon. Thank you.
Gary Wilson's essay for Great Lakes Echo is called "Will Shifting Political Winds Impair Great Lakes Recovery?" You can find a link at WMUK.org. One note on that interview with Gary Wilson. You may have heard me refer to Governor Rick Snyder's possible interest in running for president toward the end of that interview. We recorded before Snyder put out a statement late last week saying that he has no plans to run for president in 2016. Links with more information, longer versions of interviews, and archived programs can always be found at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.